I was blown away. Everything was so intense, so the colors were so strong and brilliant, and everything was in more than 3D, so clear. And I live very close to the harbor, so I walked down to the river, and I had to cross a very busy street, and there was a motorcycle passing by with really strong noise. I think they had removed the mufflers, and usually I get annoyed by that, but I didn't get annoyed. There was just the sound and nothing else, no thoughts around it. Wow, this was so beautiful.
Welcome to the Gratitude Podcast on www.georgeandbenta.com, where you'll hear a new story each week that will inspire more gratitude in your own life. Our mission is to inspire 100,000 people to discover how to feel gratitude and live a happy life through the amazing life stories of our successful guests and their actionable tips. And now, the host of our podcast, Georgian Benta.
Hi, Gratitude Seeker. Welcome to a new episode of the Gratitude Podcast. Today, with us, we have a person from a country in which we have never been. And I think it's very interesting to explore gratitude from a perspective that hasn't been explored yet, like from different countries, from different parts of the world, and also, of course, from different individual perspectives. After over 10,000 hours of meditation and 40 years of studying Buddhism, she wasn't able to stop from having debilitating fear when she found out she had breast cancer. Dr. Christiane Michelberger wasn't able to cope and question whether everything she had done up to this point was a complete lie. She discovered the book that led her to ask one simple question. That one question led to a true awakening. She realized she was spiritually sleepwalking. She had replaced one illusion for another. But this was only the first step. In her book, Finding Awakening, she shares her no-nonsense journey beyond the self to peace and freedom. Her mission is to put an end to all suffering. Isn't that amazing? Christiane, welcome to the Gratitude Podcast.
Thank you, Georgian, and thank you for having me.
My pleasure, my pleasure. And for our listeners, if the way Christiane pronounced my name seems a bit weird, it's actually how it's pronounced in Romanian. So I really appreciate Christiane for doing this and for making the effort to do this. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right. So firstly, let us know a little bit more about you. Let us know where you are right now, and also a few things that maybe I didn't mention in your short introduction.
So I'm calling in from Hamburg in Germany, which is in the northern part right at the large river Elbe. And I'm very close to the harbor here. It's a large harbor. And today it's beautiful. The sun is shining and it's cold, but very nice weather. And it's very quiet because we are all in isolation, basically. And it's a beautiful atmosphere because all the neighbors are moving closer. Yesterday, somebody put on a party on their balcony and the others came out as well.
That's so wonderful.
Yes. And I'm coming from a different perspective, but I think that what you call gratitude is actually something I'm experiencing it as well. I just don't give it that name. And I'm now working as a guide to awakening, which awakening means really finding peace which contains these feelings, which I call love joy, because to me, they are made, the molecules of these feelings are made of one atom of joy and the other atom of love. And this feeling is like a bass hum in my life. And it's basically always there. Of course, when I'm concentrating, reading something, it's covered. But then when I relax, it's just a relaxing, then it's there again. And yes, when this state is there, it's uncovered. It's actually always there. It just has to be uncovered. Then the suffering really ends, and the fear of dying, which is so prevalent right now. And all that started with an experience I had in a church. Though I'm, with my work coming from a Buddhist perspective, I'm actually very connected to Christianity as well. And apart from being a physician, I also studied the organ and played in the church until I retired during services. So I was in a concert singing with a very small choir. Each voice just had three people. And we were singing the psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd." And we were singing along. We were about half into the concert. And all of a sudden, my whole experience shifted. And I knew that these words were true, but in a totally different way than I could have ever thought. And I felt totally different as well. All of a sudden, I loved everybody around me, and though there were people I didn't really like in this choir, but I loved them too. And it was very weird, I found. How could I love just everybody? And it was a very expansive feeling, very beautiful. And I couldn't sing. I just was so absorbed by this feeling, but my colleagues managed to cover me up. I just moved my lips. And I looked, you know, I looked around with my eyes. I couldn't really move, but I looked around and thought, I wonder whether the other are experiencing this as well. Of course, I couldn't tell because they were singing. And so it was like, wow. And it was this feeling of joy, love that permeated this experience. I didn't actually call it anything at that point, not even joy, love. At that time, I had been meditating in Zen meditation for, I think, 2 years. And I just thought, ah, there is something totally different than what I know now. And this is so beautiful. And I felt very grateful for experiencing that. And it is like I caught a virus there. I caught the awakening virus. From that time on, I just couldn't stop looking for this other experience of the world that was available then, because it was so different, so loving. And I thought, this is really the love I want to experience. I didn't consider myself a very loving person. And that was so different. That's how it all started.
Wow. I absolutely love how you took us there. And I'm sure that our listeners were all also able to feel, to experience how it was for you being there, of course, probably in a small portion compared to what you experienced, but nonetheless, it's such a beautiful feeling, and I could definitely feel at least a part of that, and it feels amazing. Thank you for for taking us there. This is really wonderful. So let us know a little bit more about about this feeling that you call love joy. How do you define it? How do you see it? How do you experience it?
Well, slipping into it right now, or relaxing into it, I would say it's so hard to define a feeling. It's it's all embracing, and it's very still for me. It's peaceful but not unmoving. It's like a very fine vibration. And for me, you could definitely call this gratitude as well. Absolutely. It's a radical openness to experience, no matter how they are. Not rejecting anything, not wanting something else to be. Everything that's there or happening is just okay. It's fine. No objections. That's how I would describe it.
Wow. I love it. And it's wonderful that you used words, but I think you also use something else to let us know what it is, and that's really wonderful, and I could definitely feel it, and I hope that our listeners were able to feel it and to experience it as well. And from this point of view, I know you have a philosophy of embracing being ordinary. Can you talk a little bit about this? Can we explore this topic a little bit?
Yes, this feeling ordinary connects to what is called awakening. Usually people think that awakening, enlightenment, is something that's only for very special people, and they have to be either so virtuous that you can't believe it, or they have had to study tremendously to get there, and basically it's nearly impossible. And what I found on my journey, which was about peeling all the covers away that cover up this beautiful state, and it's basically all layers of the little me, wanting to control what's happening right now. For example, if you listen to the news, everybody wants to control, seem to be in control. Or the journalists say, if you would have done that, you would be in control. It's all about the assumption we could be in control, which is just not possible with everything. There are just things that happen, and that's how it is. And the me that thinks it can pick the thoughts and all the fantasized faculties the me seems to have, and that this, I want this, I don't want that, This is a very strong part of the me. I remember when it fell away from me after inquiring into it, what we simply do is, in this inquiry, we simply look whether there is actually a me or not. We just do what we always do when we want to find out whether something is there or not. We just look for it. And when I saw that there is no wanting and not wanting, all the reactivity ceased. Like, I don't push and pull at experience any longer. What happens is what happens. I can respond to it, but there is no emotional charge around it. I don't get angry or frustrated or irritated or whatever. And my own guide asked me, so why did you ever react? And I just pulled a blank. I had no idea why the heck did I ever think the world had to comply with what I wanted. It was so weird. And I just wrote back, I think I thought my second name was God. I mean, yes. And then in the further journey, the reality explored and seeing that we are not separate from everything else, that there is in reality no border between us and everything else. And absolutely no me. That removed all the layers that covered up the state. Now, when I was sick with breast cancer in the hospital, I didn't know any of this. I was just totally dissolved into panic. It was terrible. And by that time, I had studied Buddhism for 40 years. Had spent time in India meditating, had been with several Zen masters. I had done so much and really, really tried to get it. I had studied the Pali Canon, which are the original scriptures or talks the Buddha gave, the historical Buddha. And yes, I tried to behave in a nice way and things like that. But when I was dissolved into panic, it was just like, I couldn't do anything. I'm a physician by profession, and I specialized in psychoanalysis and psychotherapy. And even that wouldn't help. All my tricks and tips I had, I could pass out to people. They didn't help me in that at that time. And I thought, this was just all in vain. My search has failed. And still in the hospital, I felt like I turned my back to the search and kind of let go of the identity of being a seeker. It was a quite exotic identity, you know, sitting with a Japanese Zen master, and he was ever so strict, God. And then meditating to the sound of monkeys screaming in the trees in India, and the little the movement of the ox carts. I was there in the beginning of the 80s. There were still ox carts around, even in a big city. So it felt like, yeah, that was all great and really exotic. But I had acquired a new identity, that of being a spiritual seeker. And that dropped. And now I had to find, you know, breast cancer is a disease that can come. It was an early stage, but it could still come back in 25%, which is a rather large percentage. So I thought, I have to find out. I don't know how long I will have to live. And I didn't know where to go. I had exhausted my means absolutely and fully. I had no idea how I could do that. But I find it very interesting how life moves in a way that helps us out and that puts the right things in front of us at the right time. 14 days later, at that time, I was translating an American book about life, finding your life purpose. And there was another woman translating it into English. And we were friends on Facebook, and we already had met in real life too. And she liked a post where it was about that the body isn't ready for awakening. And I thought, no, that sounds interesting. Let's read that. And I read it. And in that post, a forum was mentioned where volunteers guide other people to seeing through the self. I was very clear at that point that what was causing my suffering was thinking, I have breast cancer. I might die. I'm afraid. I'm panicking. I'm going to lose myself when I'm dying. That was creating all the panic. So the self, you know, in Buddhism, there is a kind of phrase people repeat a lot. This is not me. This is not my, this doesn't belong to me. This isn't myself. This is not me. This doesn't belong to me. This is not myself. And it didn't help me a bit in my panic. So I went on this forum and I read the dialogues there. They are open to public. And at one point, there was always this moment, the dialogues didn't teach anything. They simply put out some questions for people to explore. And the questions were all about, so where is this me? And I found that so interesting. And then there came this point in each dialogue where people saw something which I didn't get. And then the dialogue changed completely and it sounded like a Zen poem. So beautiful. But I didn't understand a word any longer. And I thought, okay, something is happening there. And I thought, I'd try that. And then fear came up. I thought, gosh, what if this happens? Can I function without a me? I mean, I'm doing this. I'm writing. I'm cooking. I'm translating a book. Can I still do this afterwards? I was just in the middle of the translation. Would that work? How about my relationship with my partner? Would that still work? What if I go mad with that? I was really thinking about that. But when I read the dialogues, it always looked like the seekers there were quite nicely impressed, but they didn't go mad. They really found that life was so much easier after that. It felt quite delightful. And I thought, well, I've done more crazy things in my life. Maybe I try it. And these dialogues always involve that people have to reply every day of the week, even on the weekends. And I thought, well, I will have to have radiation after I'm discharged from the hospital, so I don't know how I'm going to take it. And maybe I'm not able to reply every day. But they had some dialogues in a book, and I downloaded the book and just took the dialogues on my Kindle into the waiting area of all the doctors I had to see after I was discharged. And kept myself busy with these questions. They were so exciting. And I thought, I never asked myself these questions. They are really good. And the questions are really the key to all the awakening. Meditating is fine, and it really helps focusing, calming down, feeling better. Meditation is great for that, but it's too general. It's not specified enough. But focusing on one question that is looking for what is actually thinking, for example. What is it? Where is this thinker of thoughts? Can I pick my thoughts? Can I know what will come up? And if I don't like it, stop it from arising before it arises. These were questions I found really fascinating. And so I had boiled it down that the I was something like a virus that was attached to everything. Every experience was I'm seeing, I'm hearing, though there was only seeing and hearing and touching something and smelling. And then in the book, it was page 20, so I wasn't even far into this book. The guide asked, so is there any eye in any physical form or shape? And I thought to myself, what a silly question, of course not. And while I was still thinking the question, a strong shift happened. I felt like I was moved to the side a bit. I'm not even sure whether that really happened or not, but it really felt like I was physically moved to the side. Everything was quiet, totally quiet. All of a sudden, there were no thoughts. And I saw clearly that there is no me and never had been. And also, I saw why I had not seen it. It had been in front of my nose all the 40 years. And I did a fist pump. I thought, yeah, that's it. And it felt like so large. I had to go outside. I couldn't stay in our apartment. And I went for a walk. And it was a Sunday. And I was blown away. Everything was so intense. So the colors were so strong and brilliant. And everything was in more than 3D. So clear. And I walked, I live very close to the harbor, so I walked down to the river and I had to cross a very busy street and there was a motorcycle passing by with a really strong noise. I think they had removed the mufflers. And usually I get annoyed by that, but I didn't get annoyed. There was just the sound and nothing else, no thoughts around it. Wow, this was so beautiful. It felt a bit strange because I could very clearly see that the other people had no core as well. And I thought, I wonder how I'm ever going to relate to anybody again. But I thought, we'll take that at a later time. Now I'm just going to enjoy. And I went down and bought an ice cream. And a girl stood in front of me with a braid, and the braids looked so beautiful, the shiny hair. Oh, it was like nearly a psychedelic trip or something. And then I came back, and my partner was still at home. I hadn't told her what happened. I didn't have words for it. And I told her, I don't exist. And she looked at me and she said, sure you do, I can see you. And I thought, oh gosh, I can't share my experience. And that was the point when I thought, I will have to find people to talk to about this. And I got that nobody can understand this if they haven't experienced it themselves. And so that was my start of getting involved with a community, the Liberation Unleashed community. That's the website, liberationunleashed.com, where the dialogues were, and to get involved with them. And, you know, after some hours, another feeling started to emerge. I felt incredibly stupid for not having seen this for 40 years. I thought, oh my. How stupid can you be to not see this? It's so simple. And this feeling statement was with me for like 2 weeks. I was like, how could I ever not see this? How could I? And I have all these Buddhist friends, and some of them had been on the path all their life. They were now in their 80s. 70s, 80s, and they were afraid to die without seeing this. And I thought, I have to help them. I have to learn how to do this, how to conduct a dialogue so they can see it too. And so I got confirmed that this was indeed a true seeing. You don't need confirmation for that. You always know if it happens. So it's just a kind of Yes, getting a feedback on that. But in the beginning, I couldn't express myself really well. And so I didn't get a confirmation. I thought, well, if they think I haven't seen it, I can't make them believe it. I know I have. That's all I can say. And and then I started to guide them myself and learned it. And as you said, it was only the first step, because after a while, I discovered that the reactivity came back and that there were things I wanted and didn't want, but there was no way how to address that. And with this wanting and not wanting, the sense of I want it is there. It's part of the multi-layered self-illusion. It really has many layers, eight layers. And this sense of self can be strengthened when the next layer is open to be worked with. But I didn't know how, and so I just learned how to guide, and I really loved that, helping people to experience this big relief of there being no me. It was so wonderful.
Wow.
That's how it all started, with the awakening.
I can definitely tell you that you've made great progress with this, and many of the things that you've experienced, I could definitely relate to, and could definitely feel a part of that. And that's amazing, because I know it was very hard for me too when I had the experience that got me to start this podcast, that it wasn't really easy to put it into words and to make sense of it and to talk about it. And I think you're doing a great job with this.
Thank you so much. Yes, it's really a space beyond words. Mm-hmm. And I mean, really, can we put anything into words? I mean, have you ever tried to describe the taste of an apple to somebody who has never seen it? It's impossible.
That's so true.
But when you have tasted an apple and somebody described it to you, you will recognize it. Even though the words are missing most of the experience, you can still recognize it. And that's how you recognize the experience.
That's so true and so beautiful. But I also wanted to get into something else. How can we find this sweet contentment by seeing past desires? How do we do that?
It works with a very simple question. It works with the question, why do I react? What makes me react? And it can be used in any situation we react to. It's good if it's more a situation that lasts longer, because if the situation passes quickly, it's hard to still work with it. So I used a very personal thing in my relationship and just stated what is happening, or what is actually, I framed it the other way around, and that's always a good way to start, because if we frame what's happening straight away, we usually react too strongly to be able to watch why we react, because it's too fast. So, for example, I'll give an example. Maybe each evening, you have children, and each evening you get so annoyed because they don't want to brush their teeth and make a big drama out of it, and it takes half an hour until you're done. So what would you do? You would take, Robert is not brushing his teeth at night without kicking and screaming. And then just intone the sentence. It's good to do it in a quasi-lab condition first, because in the heat of the moment, when you have to do something, it's really hard. And then wait for the primary sensations to arise. It will feel really uncomfortable, because that's where we react. We want to get away from the uncomfortable feeling. So Robert doesn't brush his teeth without kicking and screaming, feeling the uncomfortable feelings. I wait for what arises that starts the anger about it or the frustration. Why do I react? What starts this reaction? And just waiting for it, just waiting for it. At one point, there is clearly seen that there is nothing that makes us react. And again, you'll know when it has been seen, it cannot be overlooked. And then in the first step, reactivity will weaken in all other areas as well. It doesn't just weaken in this regard with a kid, but also in other areas. Usually you have to address that several times. Wanting and not wanting is really a thick layer. And it always takes at least two times and often several more. The second one I worked with was my desire for chocolate. And I noticed that I noticed that when I sit at my desk, I work online, I often get up and just to grab something to eat. And I thought, that's weird. And so what I did is, when I had this urge to get up and get something to eat or a piece of chocolate, I just paused and waited and thought, ask myself, what do I actually want right now? What needed to happen? Or what could somebody do or say so I would forget about eating something now? And I immediately knew it. And it really took me on a deep, very deep level. I wanted somebody to hold me, to just hold me without talking any words. And it connected me to my early childhood. My parents fled from the eastern part of Germany in 50, right? And in October, and I was born in January 51. And Hamburg was still totally bombed. Picture Syria, any town in Syria that's bombed. That's how Hamburg looked like. And we lived in a basement of a bombed house, and my parents had to build up a life again, and I was parked in a daycare center with many, many, many babies, because all their parents need to somehow get a life back. And there was just nobody to hold me as a baby. And I connected to that, and I connected to that fear. There was so much fear around that, and I only could sit with it and wait for what made me want to calm this with something to eat. It was really strong. In hindsight, I always thought it lasted for months, but it didn't. I wrote it all down. It only lasted for a few days. It was like, I think, 5 days. And during that days also, my niece married and I was there. And I stayed in a hotel. And in the free time between the ceremonies and meeting, I sat with this because the fear was so strong, I could hardly sleep. And at one point, I just sat on my hotel bed and said, I'm not going to get up before this is resolved, because the fear was just too much. And I just sat there. And with the sentence I worked with, what, there is nobody. And this there is nobody was so strong. And I just sat there with the fear and let it rage and watched out for what started this, trying to move away from this feeling. And I think it was after 3/4 of an hour, everything collapsed. The fear was gone, as if I had woken up from a nightmare. And there was no fear. The sentence, "there isn't anybody there," didn't get any emotional response any longer. I was just sitting there on my bed, wondering what had just happened. And after that, the reactivity was gone. What's very interesting is that after this shift and after many others, a kind of testing period starts. I have no idea how this is arranged, but I was still in the hotel getting ready to go home by train, and a phone call reached me. It was from the radiology department where I was treated with radiation. And during the treatment, you see a doctor each week. And they said, "I'm very sorry, but Dr. So-and-so isn't available this week. Would it be all right with you to see Dr.?" And now, they were very kind because I had had a meltdown when I had to change doctors once before that. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what to say. It was like, wow. I didn't have any thoughts, and I also didn't have any feelings. I just thought, wow. And I didn't know what to say. And then the woman was so kind, and she said, "Yes, I understand that's not nice for you and uncomfortable," and just kept, you know, trying to soothe me. And in the end, the only thing I could say was, "It's all right." And the it's so, you know, when the usual reactions don't happen, it's such a weird feeling. It's like trying to start a car, and it keeps idling, but the car doesn't start, and then you just have to stop. It's running. We in German we say running into the empty space in a way. And during the journey, all this kind of stuff happened. Like I had arranged to meet a friend on the way back to Hamburg on one of the stations for 2 hours. And our station was, our train was late. And I do not like to be late, and I do not like people to be late. And so I was waiting for getting frustrated now, but I didn't. They were late, and that was all. It was just a fact.
That's wonderful. It's we have a saying here in Romania about German people that they are never late, and they don't want people to be late. And I have this too. I've been raised by my mom and my grandma to make sure I abide to this as well, and it's interesting. I can definitely relate to the experience, because this is how I was in the past too. Like, I was on time, or usually a bit before time, and if people weren't there on time, I was very angry, and I felt like it was disrespectful, and so on and so forth. And definitely I can relate to this experience.
Yes, exactly. That's how I reacted too, usually. And then, you know, I had booked a local train, and they are double deckers. They have another seating area in the first You can go upstairs.
Yeah,
and there is a glass ceiling and you can look out, and it was fall. And there the leaves were so beautiful everywhere. And I said, I'm going to walk up there and sit there and look at the leaves, right? And then all the first story was all first class, and I couldn't sit there. And again, there was no reaction. So I went downstairs and I just looked at the leaves from there, and everything was just perfectly fine.
Exactly.
And I had to change trains at one station. And usually when I change trains, there's always a little bit of time, and I go get a coffee and something sweet. And I went and got a coffee, but the sweet stuff didn't appeal to me. And I thought, now things are getting really weird. So I went back with my coffee. And it's so amazing. If this soothing is no longer needed, then everything is just really totally okay as it is and can be thoroughly enjoyed. And I just phoned my friend and said, hey, I'll be late. And she said, yeah, fine, because trains can be late. She was all right with that.
That's wonderful. Yeah. That's mm-hmm. wonderful. And I couldn't help but make a connection. And maybe mm-hmm. you know about this too. When we are in... in Hardwiring Happiness, Rick Hansen talks about our two ways of operating from a brain's perspective. Mm-hmm. One is reactive and one is responsive.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually used those exact words, that in the past you used to react to things and now you respond to things. And I think that's amazing how it correlates.
Right. I actually think that this kind of inquiry I now guide people in is changing the way the brain registers the world. And to me, it must be that it's changing from a more left hemispherical experience, where we think and comment all the time on what's happening and analyze it, to a more right hemispherical experience, which is just about experiencing it with all the narrative about it. Maybe that's the responsive way of living. Yeah. I wonder.
It's very possible, yeah.
And that's also because it's so beyond words, because right hemispherical experience is without words. It's just the sensual experience.
Exactly, yeah. And of course, this goes hand in hand with gratitude. This goes hand in hand with how we experience life through the lens of gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
When we focus on those experiences, on those things that we appreciate, and look for those things that we appreciate, and become aware of the things that we already see but might have not seen in the past as things that we can appreciate, it's something that's very similar to this.
Yes, I would take that even further. I would say, even staying with the discomfort of the present experience without looking for something to appreciate, just staying with the body sensations. Every feeling has body sensations and a name. And just leaving the name behind, feeling the body sensations, every uncomfortable feeling will dissolve on its own. By the way, this is scientifically researched. It takes about 90 seconds. And there will be gratitude will just be there without even trying to induce it. Because it's the feeling that's left when we just stay with experience.
So that's 1 minute and 30 seconds. This is all we need to do.
Yes, just tuning into the body sensations. Not making them bigger or larger. Leaving behind the thought narrative. Oh, this is so terrible. How can I feel better? Moving away from the experience. In the moment, we just stay put, feeling it. all the suffering leaves and there is only gratitude left.
Wow. I love this thought, and I think it's a wonderful thought to end this interview with. Let our audience know where they can find you, where can they get in touch with you, where can they find your book.
Yes, if you want to come to a place where you can experience this gratefulness as your natural state, you can find me at findingawakening.com. That's my website. My book isn't out yet. I'm in the process of editing it, and it takes so long. So this will take a bit until it's out. But you'll know if you subscribe to my newsletter, and you can also find me on Facebook, either under my name, Christiane Michelberger, or under Finding Awakening. I have a public profile, so you can find me easily.
Thank you so much for your time, for all the amazing feelings and experiences that you've shared with us, and just for being here so present and so warm. Thank you.
Thank you, Georgian. It was such a pleasure speaking to you.
Hey, Gratitude Seeker. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this interview. I really appreciate it. And if you could think of one person that would also benefit from it, share it with them. It might actually be the inspiration that they need to make their day, or maybe even their life, much better. Thank you so much once again. This has been Georgian Benta. Don't forget to keep seeking and spreading gratitude.